This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 10th, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. We're going to go ahead and look this week at some of the developments in taxes, but we're going to start out with some comments received on a case that we discussed last week. So let's move directly to that. These are comments received on the AgriHall case. That is a case from the Ninth Circuit a week ago. That is 145 TC number 5. That, if you need reminding, is the case of the packaging materials in the farming operation. In this case, we had discussed, the tax court had spent a lot of time discussing how Section 1.162-3 of the regulations would apply to packaging materials used in a farming operation. When I discussed it last week, I noted that that regulation has changed, and the particular justification the court used to come to its conclusion in this case would no longer be valid because the sentence it had relied upon simply isn't there anymore, and the treatment specified by 1.162-3 would apparently mandate a different treatment, in this case, mandate that they capitalize those items. Well, as the week went on, I should say, I got a call early in the week from Roger McCown of the Center for Agricultural Law at Iowa State University, and he called to discuss issues here about how this case had come down and what he believed was essentially something that should solve the problem, and that is Regulation 1.162-12. That regulation, which covers farming operations, says right at the start, a farmer who operates a farm for profit is entitled to deduct from gross income as necessary expenses all amounts actually expended in the carrying on of a business of farming. Regulation goes on to specifically allow deduction for ordinary tools or short life or small costs, which includes hand tools, shovels, rakes, etc. Now, he pointed out that farmers have generally taken the position that this regulation essentially is what allows the use of the cash basis generally for the farmers. A special treatment that the court mentioned, that, you know, farmers have been generally allowed the cash basis, though the court never mentioned this reg. Now, the only hitch with that was that the court apparently, we discovered later in the week and I continued discussions, was apparently briefed on this issue, but in the actual decision, the court never mentioned this regulation. So the judge writing the decision did not mention 1.162-12. That raises questions because if, in fact, 1.162-12 takes care of the problem, then it seems like we spent a lot of time on an issue that never should have been discussed in this case. Even more interesting and kind of troubling is that this is a reported tax court decision, which means it essentially went by all of the tax court judges who didn't express any reservations or indicate any other reason not to publish this case. It is doubt there is a published case. Now, that said, it's still always dangerous to try to read anything out of a court's silence on a topic, and the court never said anything about 12 or 12's application, or more relevant in this point, non-application to this particular situation. And clearly the result in this case for the year in question is one the taxpayer wanted. They got the ruling that they wanted. Our problem becomes more going forward. Why didn't 12 get mentioned? Well, it could be simply because you didn't need to. 3 would have covered it. So if 3 didn't force capitalization, 12 never would. The other side of the equation is, maybe they're saying that 3 changes it. We just don't know. For right now, nothing really has changed. In essence, there's nothing there to directly change your interpretation of 1.162.12 if you've been using that to justify. Remember, this has been packaging materials is the nature of this case. It seems pretty clear from the IRS's concessions in the case that they agreed that the 464 rules, which remember dealt with farming syndicates, essentially blessed writing off seeds, fertilizer, and all that sort of thing. And the court did agree that these packaging materials were not that sort of thing. Remember, because the taxpayer in this case argued that too, went with the service, well, if those are all blessed, this is one of the blessed things. And the court said, well, you know, this isn't part of that 464, so it wouldn't affect 464, but then went on to other justifications. So it's one to keep an eye on. Now, the question becomes, the IRS did lose this case, so if it's going to be appealed, it would be appealed to the Ninth Circuit. If they take it up, they may decide the case, and they may actually deal with the 12 issue, which could be a way that resolve the problem without, and therefore not open up the obvious question about what about new 3. In any event, if you're in agriculture, keep an eye on this because I think we're still kind of watching to see why this case is written the way it was, why it was a published decision, and secondly, you know, does this mean anything about the impact of new Dash 3 since old Dash 3 was used as the underlying reason the court gave for this decision? Now let's move on to some developments for this week. This is the case of Klein versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-144. This is another passive activity case. The IRS has been very interested in passive activities going after that for taxpayers. In this case, the taxpayer, who was a pilot, and who was a pilot approaching retirement age for the airline he worked with, began an operation in the British Virgin Islands chartering catamarans. Now, some of these he skippered himself, but he also used a management company to basically lease it out sans skipper. And he'd go down there twice per year. There were two times per year. They're basically for each of the boats, and he had two catamarans. And on each one, he had 2-week period twice during the year where he could get use of the catamaran. And those he would book on his own, normally with friends, and he would skipper the boat, and he would basically get his expenses out of that plus a fee for skippering the boat. Now, the question the IRS raised was that this lost money. They went after 469, saying it was a passive activity. In this case, they did not have a log, but the court looked at the information which they brought in, which, by the way, they reconstructed from actual evidence they had underlying, which always is helpful rather than these guesses that people write down after the fact, but reconstructed looking at data and coming up with reasonable approximations of hours. Again, there's a key difference between this and those people who just off the top of their head start throwing numbers down. And they decided clearly they had worked more than 100 hours, that the husband and wife had worked in the first year, because Mr. Klein was single in year one, he'd worked more than 100, and in year two, he and his spouse had worked more than 100. Now, they claim more than 500 in the second year, but the court never addressed whether it totally bought the more than 500, but it did clearly buy they had more than 100 hours. They also found, looking at the evidence of what happened with the management company, that the management company employees, no employee from the management company had truly spent more than 100 hours working on the ship. Even though there weren't direct, detailed records of which employee did everything, the head of the management company testified that they didn't assign any specific employee. The biggest thing they did was a turnaround fee where they cleaned the boat, got it ready. You know, after it came back from an outing, they would do all the cleaning, they would do the servicing, they'd get it back ready to go, you know, nice, perfect shape, ready for the next thing that would go out. And there they had determined that during those years they had records of total hours and they had three employees who did it, so the court was okay considering that on average these employees had spent maybe 35 to 40 hours in each of the 2 years on the boats. Each employee had spent that much. And they felt, well, that was clearly below 100. And by the way, even if it wasn't below 100, it was still far less than the husband and wife had spent, or the husband the first year. And therefore, the court found that for this reason, they essentially had materially participated. They met the test for more than others, as required in the regulation 1.469-5TA3. That's one of the ways you can materially participate. So the court allowed the loss deduction. Partnerships have become a big deal for the IRS recently, and we've had two developments in the area of partnership issues this week. First, the IRS issued final and proposed regulations in the areas of a partnership change in interest. This is Treasury Decision 9728, and the proposed reg found at Regulation 109370-10, both issued on August the 3rd. What this does is revises the rule for allocations among the partners in year in which there is a change in the partner's interest. Now, the proposed regulations deal with two special cases under 706. They're cash basis items in the situation with a change of interest and items that exist in lower tier partnerships. Those are not part of these regulations. Those are part of proposed regs, and those proposed regs are not yet final. So you want to keep an eye on those, but what we do have is a final method. Generally, if there is a change in interest during the year, we're going to have some rules that we have to use in this case. Now, one big thing that is true, there are two exceptions to these rules generally. Now, the first exception is if, in fact, you have what's called contemporaneous partners. That is when all the partners, both before and after the change in interest, have the, you know, they're the same partner. So everybody stays in the partnership both before and after. And the change is not attributable to a contribution of money or property by a partner of the partnership or a distribution of money or property by a partner. Then you can do whatever you want with allocations as long as you meet the 704B rules. Remember, what these deal with is the general rule is you can change the partnership agreement right up until the unextended due date of the return. But this says this has been a change in interest. You're not allowed to do that. There's also an exception if you have a service partnership. If capital is not a material income-producing factor, you also are not subject to these rules. This is a change from the proposed regs where it had been limited to what were essentially qualified personal service entities, the things that would be qualified personal service corporations if we had incorporated the entity. Now it's any service partnership will qualify for this treatment. If you don't meet the service partnership requirement or you don't have the contemporaneous partner rule met, then you can account for either of two ways. You can use either a cutoff method, or if all the partners agree and we don't have what's called an extraordinary item, you can use an interim closing method. The regulations go on and describe simplifying assumptions you can use with the interim closing method, basically in most cases, or we can use a per day allocation. Now, if you can't, and I should say interim closing is doesn't need the agreement of all partners, per day needs the agreement of all partners. This is kind of the reverse of the S corporation situation. So if we have that situation where all the partners don't agree, then we have to use this closing method. Now, if it's an extraordinary item, and the regulations provide for a list of extraordinary items in the regulations, and you'll see in our materials at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, we have a list of those, then you have to use the interim closing method in order to allocate that. And what you do is you allocate everybody's interest through that date, and then you allocate after, and we're not allowed to change their allocation after the fact. So we have to allocate per what the agreement says at the time that transaction takes place. If we don't, if all partners agree, we can do it just like an S corporation, which is going to be an interest on a per day basis and allocate day by day. But that requires the agreement of all partners. And you must keep a record, you must keep in the partnership's records a copy of the agreement you receive from all partners to allow that method to go forward. Generally rules, the regulations give us what's essentially a 10-step method of doing this when it occurs, and talks about the issue there about the documents you need to keep. Again, check that out at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If capital is not a material income producing item, as I mentioned, don't remember the rule does not apply. So for law firms, accounting firms, this isn't really going to be a problem. However, if you have, let's say, a trucking company, now you got a problem. Also with partnerships this year, we have a notice, 2015-54. The IRS decided some people had been abusing the rules under 704C. 704C deals with basically differences between fair value and basis and asset that existed before a partner puts in the partnership. The IRS has announced they will issue proposed regulations to deal with this in a situation where you have a partner who contributes appreciated assets to a partnership that the partner and a related foreign partner control. If that's true, the IRS, generally under 704C, you're allowed to use one of three methods of allocating that pre-contribution gain. And except for the remedial method, the other two methods may allow part of that gain to end up not being allocated under this rule, but be allocated under the rules that are going to be governed by the standard 704B. Those things normally happen after the asset came, after we started as partners. The IRS believes that some people have been abusing the situation and designing transactions where there would be a triggering of the recognition issue, but at the time, the ceiling rule would operate to force the partnership to ignore parts of this and so effectively transfer the gain, have the gain kind of move over to the foreign partner, or at least the contributing partner would never have to pick that up, even though their capital account would have been adjusted to recognize the fact that they had that additional contribution. If you do not follow the rules in this notice, and it'll be the proposed regs that come out, the IRS will deny the non-recognition treatment for the contribution of the property. Generally, 721A says if you contribute property to a partnership, we don't recognize any gain or loss. If you don't meet these rules, we will have to recognize it. It will mandate the use of the remedial allocation for 704C in these situations. And these rules are effective as of August 6, 2015, for any property contributed after that date, or if you make a check-the-box election to become a partnership after that date. It will affect even if the assets were contributed before August 6th. That's interesting because, as we'll note, the regs are not yet out in proposed form, nor are they final, but you still have to follow them. The service will now move forward on that. Also, the service notes that they're not agreeing that they're not going to concede that, you know, what the proper treatment was before this. I should also note they plan to also issue some regulations under 481A, which talks about the issue of when they try to when we have the related party allocations. In this case, we'll do it, I should say 42, related party transactions, that they may force some recognition there in this case because they believe in some cases partnerships are not properly valuing the asset coming in. That's also being used to shift that appreciation offshore where it won't be taxed. Next up, we have a case of Dinger versus Commissioner, TC Memo 2015-145. And this deals both with an issue on the foreign earned income exclusion and the issue about how much you can rely upon a prior victory against the IRS when the IRS conceded. The individual in question was an employee of the U.S. Army Dental Clinic in Germany. Now, she worked there in Germany. She actually was a non-resident alien who was married to a U.S. citizen and therefore made the election to be treated, you know, to have all of her income taxed so they could file a joint return. When they did that, she always claimed the foreign earned income exclusion. Now, generally, the catch is you cannot claim the foreign earned income exclusion if you are if you're an employee of a U.S. agency. So if you work for the Army, you can't claim it, even though you're doing work in Germany. But she was paid by a German agency under a NATO agreement that had the German agency pay for these things in Germany. Although she was paid with U.S. funds, and as the court pointed out, the Army had the right to hire, fire, set her hours, do everything else. Now, she claimed that, you know, in fact, she was being paid by the German agency. That meant she qualified for the 9/11 exclusion because she was technically an employee of the German agency. The tax court said, no, we're going to treat you as a U.S. Army employee because the agreement with the German office said specifically this is not an activity of the German civil service. The payments made by the home country and subject to recovery. So she could not qualify for the 9/11 exclusion. However, she pointed out, you know, in prior years, the IRS had examined her for the same issue. And in both of those years, before the case got to tax court, the IRS had conceded the issue and allowed her the full deduction and submitted basically a decision to the tax court that was recorded that dismissed it with no tax due. So the taxpayer in this case, Ms. Dinger, said, well, the IRS can't change their tune here since they previously conceded it. They've got to allow me the deduction this year. The tax court said no. They noted that the case had never actually gone to trial. So this is not the case where, by the way, if the case had gone to trial and been decided, then we would have had an issue of the IRS can't come back in and try to relitigate it every year. However, in this case, they'd merely conceded the case. There had been no stipulation of facts or just the IRS stopped litigating it. So the court said they're not bound by that. The IRS had perfectly within their rights to now pursue it in this year, and that's what they did. That's important to remember that merely the fact that you won something in one year does not mean, unless you got all the way to court and your win was in court, that that's going to hold for future years unless the IRS specifically agreed it's going to hold for future years. Next up is a case of Waterhouse versus United States, United States Court of Federal Claims case, 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5080. The actual decision was released on July the 23rd. Now, this is the case of a responsible person penalty. This gentleman in this case was a construction company, and this particular gentleman was a 40% shareholder. He ran the operations. There was a 20% shareholder and another 40% shareholder. The other 40% shareholder took care of all the financial obligations of the entity. So this taxpayer would go out. He was on job sites. He supervised the company's jobs. He kept everything running. But he didn't go ahead and write checks day to day. He did have authority to sign checks. And he did from time to time sign them. He also had the ability to hire and fire employees. he was aware that there were unpaid taxes because the IRS had shown up and his partner had told him the IRS had shown up and his partner and he met from time to time. But he had assumed because the company had always paid its taxes that in fact his partner would take care of that and he had enough to do running operations. And as he pointed out, had he walked in and simply started writing checks, he simply stepped on his partner's area of responsibility, that would probably have blown up the company. And I think many of us who have partners, you know, many of us who work in organizations where we have other owners, we know that's true. We've made agreements with each other, right? I take care of this, you take care of that. And if the other party just walks in and makes a unilateral decision that's not in their area, that causes all kinds of problems and friction. So he said, well, I should be able to rely on that. And the other shareholder admitted that, yes, he took care of all that and he thought everything would be paid, but everything just moved too fast when the company finally ran under and the IRS remained unpaid. Well, that agreement that he wouldn't touch finances may have been great, and the court even agreed operationally it probably was the only way to run the company. But the court said, here's the problem. For purposes of the responsible person penalty, it's not relevant. The only relevant point for that penalty is, did you have the right to get the taxes paid? Could you have done so? Did you allow other people to be paid after you became aware the taxes were unpaid? And he did, because he knew he was hiring employees. He was meeting payroll. He knew from employees telling him that from time to time the checks bounced, so he knew there were financial difficulties. Once he became aware there were unpaid taxes and the company had financial difficulties, he had a responsibility to assure those taxes got paid. He did not take that. He technically had a requirement, if he didn't want to be liable for this, to essentially walk in the door and tell his partner to either pay the taxes or he'd pay them, and then essentially that means, if necessary, blow up the enterprise. But the problem, he didn't do that, so he now is held to be a responsible person, potentially liable for the taxes, and presumably, since the IRS is coming after him and we know the other party admitted that the other party was a responsible party, presumably Mr. Waterhouse is collectible and his partner may very well not be. So bad news in that realm. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August 10, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you, as always, by Nichols Patrick, CPA Incorporated, and by your State Society of CPAs. Be sure to go ahead and check on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com for links to the actual case materials and other information for this week's broadcast, as well as other information on updates as they occur during the week. And if you do have comments, please be sure to send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, and we'll try to take care of those there as too. So if you have any issues, questions, or you want to ask me something, go ahead and forward it, and if we have time next week, we'll try to pick that up. And I hope you'll join us next week as we discuss developments in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.